Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. Normally, it's a weekly news and talk show about what's cool, new, and we're talking about in the books and reading, but every time and again, it is not, and today it is not. We are doing one of our occasional features, Book Nerd Movie Club, where we read a book that we have or haven't read before, and then watch the movie upon which watch the movie that is adapted from the source material, and talk about the twain together. Today, we are talking about The Martian, the book by Andy Weir, the movie written the screenplay written by Drew Goddard and directed by Ridley Scott, based on that book starring Matt Damon. And we're doing it because, A, we like the book and the movie. That's one reason. But based on a conversation we had during our fall preview draft, which you can go listen to, bookriot.com/fall draft. There'll be a link in the show notes, bookriot.com/listen. We had an occasion to talk about how much we like The Martian and one of the books that I picked, and maybe be one of the reasons I'm getting the votes, whatever votes I am getting, people are mentioning a particular book. I'm going to be cagey. Go listen to it. Gumroad, it's been really interesting. We've learned a lot. You can download the MP3 DRM free or listen in Gumroad's app. I'm not sure we'll use the same platform again. We've gotten a lot of good feedback. Thank you so much for your feedback. It's been very interesting and very helpful.
Incredibly useful.
But one thing that's been said is that people really enjoyed the draft. I think we've got this kind of down, in that the new tweak where we don't know each other's, we don't have the same draft board, and we took Harlem Shuffle off the top because we both have picked number one, I think made for some interesting conversations down the line. But in the course of that, we had the occasion to remember again how much we liked The Martian and how much we liked the movie, and we were on schedule to be ready to do another one of these. So that ergo, we're doing The Martian by Andy Weir, which we're going to get into in just a minute. But first, sponsor break, then we'll come back.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee. So I am super excited about this one. It has what sounds like a really interesting, unique magic system. It is a medical magic system, and the world is based in a Vietnam-inspired fantasy world. And it follows Nika, who is what you call a blood carver. And blood carvers are these beings who can alter human biology with a single touch. Now, to people like Thumis, she is a monster who can be traded for gold. So one day she gets caught and she's forced to heal the last witness to a high profile murder. And all signs in her investigation point to an alluring physician's aide, Cochin. But then she discovers Cochin is not who he says he is. And she's suddenly faced with a greater evil lurking in the city. Now, her only chance to survive lies in a choice. She can become the monster the city fears or risk the future of her kind. Amazing. I'm so excited. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on The Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode.
All right, Rebecca, I've got a little bit of an outline. It's kind of along the lines of what we've done before.
Yeah.
A couple of things occurred to me. One is, I think this is the first one we've done where the book was out and we had read it before the movie was ever a thing. So that our primary first, there was no, you know, oh my gosh, that we've talked about on this show. Can you remember another one that's been like this before?
Oh, I can't. But of course, now that you're asking me, I'm blanking on every other version of this.
We've done Fried Green Tomatoes. We've done Jurassic Park. Amanda and I did Hunt for Red October.
We did.
I can't think of one where you and I had our primary experience was solely with the book. And then the other thing is.
You're right. Oh, we did Romeo and Juliet.
Right. Which we weren't around for the original of that. Right. Though I'm feeling older these days.
Obviously.
And then the other thing is, you and I read, we were doing Book Riot. Like, this was a Book Riot contemporaneous thing where we were reading The Martian. It had a moment among our staff. I think maybe we played some marginal part of The Martian having a publishing moment, right?
Yeah, I think we maybe played a marginal role. Bob was like, why are you doing The Martian? And I was like, well, you know, because we felt like it. But it is about 10 years ago right now. It was originally published in 2011. And that is when Book Riot was born. And those two things are definitely inextricably linked in my mind. Early Book Riot days and The Martian coming out.
So I guess, unusually for us, we can talk about having read the book with the movie not being in existence, which I don't think we could for any of the other ones. I think all the other movies we've done, my first experience with the title was the movie, The Shawshank. I guess Romeo and Juliet. I probably saw... Did I see the... It doesn't matter. But like at the very least, they were out there in the culture together in a way that this wasn't. Can you remind me, do you remember, what's your sense memory of reading The Martian for the first time? How did it come to you? Do you remember any of this?
Yeah, I have a really strong sense memory of it, which is kind of surprising for me, because usually about 6 months after I read something, most of it has faded.
It's like a half-life of carbon. It just disappears and it's no longer radioactive.
Yeah, which I remember that I liked that, but I won't like remember many details of things. Yes, so it was early days of The Martian. I remember that Liberty Hardy was talking about how great The Martian was for months, and she is always ahead of the curve, and that at some point I must have gotten a galley in the mail. I remember it was a paper galley, and it was 2011, so e-reading was not great at the time. And I remember, I don't remember when I started it, but I remember that I finished it lying in bed in the middle of the night the same day. That it was like, oh boy, I'm in. I just got sucked in. I'm in it. What's going to happen to this guy? And that experience of like staying up way past my bedtime to finish a book happens to me maybe twice a decade. Like, I'm very devoted to my bedtime. And so I remember finishing this in the middle of the night and being like, whoa.
It's like the rarest thing that most readers get. Maybe some people operate this a lot of the time where you stay up and you can't wait to read the book. A lot of the times that's not how it happens for me, I should say. It's memorable. And I guess that brings to mind the exception to the rule I just said of we haven't done these where we had an experience of the book first. The other one that's like this, frankly, is The Da Vinci Code, which we knew the book first. And then the movie came out later. But a similar kind of reading urgency to it that I can count. I mean, I'm thinking about like The Road. I'm thinking about The Da Vinci Code. I'm thinking about The Martian. I think about IQ... was one that I got into that, but like it's pretty rare that this happens. And then the other thing I think both of you and I did is we started recommending it to people not in our book lives, right? I mean, I certainly did that.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and ask Bob if he remembers, but I think that after I read this, within a year or two later, we listened to it on audio together. I'm pretty sure that happened. I might be inventing that memory because this is the kind of book that we listen to together on a trip. But yeah, I recommended this so widely. And it was one of those Swiss Army picks for years. By the time we started this show in 2014?
Something like that. I think that's right. Yeah.
Folks were, whenever we did our first gift recommendations show, people were still, the book was recent enough and the movie was new and people were asking, what can I read that's like The Martian? And it's not as recent now, so that's sort of faded, but it does have so much utility and it's good for so many different kinds of readers, which I think is something we should come back to in talking about how do you make a science fiction book that you don't have to be a science fiction fan to read.
So it's in rereading again. I hadn't read it since I read it the first time. I hadn't come back to read it again. I don't typically reread pleasure reads like this, especially one where a lot of the momentum of the book is how is this going to all shake out? On the other hand, I have rewatched the movie several times, which yes. I think is interesting. One, you can do it in 2 hours, and Michelle likes it. I've watched with my family, and my family, we watched it together last night, had a really grand old time watching it. So interestingly, my primary experience has shifted to the movie. That's when I think of The Martian as like, where's the locus of gravity, I guess. It's the movie is, and the book is the thing upon from whence it came. But I think that the things I liked about the movie are all there in the book, maybe just more yes. so. So I've got a four-part theory about why The Martian works. Would you like to hear it?
Of course you do. Obviously.
And then you can tell me how I'm right or wrong, or how else you want to gild the lily of my rightness, Showtime. First and foremost, I think these are in no particular order, but I think this is the first one. Robinson Crusoe in space is a great idea.
Yes.
It's just a good idea. I don't know what else to say. I can't believe someone hasn't done like this. Apollo 13 is this a little bit like, how do you survive? But it's different. The difference is you're not talking to Houston the whole time with the Martian. It's a dude, and it's a dude, and we can talk about that later, but it's a person by themselves having to make it work and watching mm-hmm. them work. And that's mm-hmm. a great idea. We haven't seen it like this in a long time. Castaway with Tom Hanks is a similar idea, but that yes. is almost literally Robinson Crusoe. But there's several key differences between that The Martian adds to Castaway that make it more pleasurable. And the second one is lean into the science.
Yep.
Figure stuff out. You have a scientist. It's a science-heavy environment. You got to do a lot of science to survive on Mars. Whereas if you're surviving on an island, probably not as much. Maybe if you know a little bit of biology, you can eat. Maybe if you're a botanist on an island, you can eat that and not eat that. Whatever, you're a doctor, you can remove your own tooth, the most harrowing scene out of Castaway. But there's a lot more figuring crap out to do in space. And mm-hmm. that's what makes this fun. You got to figure mm-hmm. crap out.
Yeah, it's just like one problem after another. And the problems aren't solved by, am I strong enough to chop down this tree? Or like, what's the weather going to do? All these things that are uncontrollable. But like, can I figure this out with my brain? And I think that's appealing to people too. I think it's also yes. one of the reasons that that this is so widely relatable, is that everybody knows what it's like to try to like puzzle through something, and can I figure this out? And it's also some wish fulfillment and some fantasy of like, whatever the thing is that I'm super good at, I'd be able to like solve myself in an emergency situation with my brain. It's really mm-hmm. appealing to consider.
Yeah, there's definitely a high anthropology here of the possibilities of one person with good intent and pluck and, you know, a couple yeah. of PhDs, what they can do.
Well, yeah, and even the closing lines of the book that are something along the closing paragraph is something along the lines of like, it just, you know, they came back to get me, because it reflects this like fundamental human thing that humans want to take care of each other, and humans are good and will show up. And that's a really generous and inspiring reading too.
Which I'm not sure has been borne out over the last couple of years in a lot of ways. I'd save that for my...
Did you sense what, my hesitation?
What questions we have about how this would actually go down, or you know, try not to think... We usually do a segment that's like, try not to think about it too hard. Like mm-hmm. one of the things, and one of them is along those lines. So lean into the science. Robinson Crusoe in space is a good idea. Two more. One is the live blogging epistolary structure really works.
Yes.
Right? It works.
It's so good.
It just works.
Yeah, and I think it's that sort of present tenseness of like, he's not yeah. writing in present tense, but you feel like he's telling you about what happened right as it just happened, because it's laid out of like, this happened on Sol 12 and then Sol 35. It's not a stitched together narrative all told in retrospect. And that, here's today, what's going to happen tomorrow, who knows, is so yeah. wonderful. Yeah.
Right. As opposed to, say, I guess the foil I'm using is Castaway, which is a lot, if Tom Hanks is saying anything, they have to invent this idea of Wilson the ball. Right. Just to have something there, well, some externality to talk at.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know that he's just talking in the book. He's just talking to the computer where he's keeping mm-hmm. the log. And in the movie, it feels like he's talking to us, but it's in real time. There's not an opening scene where we know that he's, you know, in his 60s on Earth,
right.
telling his story to someone. The stakes are really high and the ending is a question.
And the conceit at the beginning of The Martian, at least, and the movie as well, is that there's sort of, I'm doing this for posterity, live blogging-ness of it, mm-hmm. because at that point he doesn't know how long it'll be before anyone realizes he was there. And as a good scientist, wants to document, like, what yeah. happened, what went wrong. Eventually it becomes more of a live blogging kind of for sanity kind of reason, I think. And then eventually he's in contact with Earth. Oh, I guess I should say there's spoilers.
If you haven't seen it,
please don't do this. But yeah, we're going to spoil it. And that's, it feels very believable now. And in an increasingly social media world, that he would be inclined just personality-wise to live blog it, even without the science sort of rationale, yeah, makes sense. It doesn't feel phony. It doesn't feel fake. It doesn't feel forced in a way that, in the book, it feels a little bit like, would he really be writing all this out in this way for posterity? Mm-hmm. Probably not. But yeah, if he's talking into a camera, it's just different. It's more of a, the performance is on, it's not subtext, it is text that he's performing for the camera.
I thought that was one of the smartest adaptations that they made in going into the film, is that he's just talking to the camera, which of course, I guess the alternative would have been that Matt Damon voices over the entire movie reading those logs, and that would not have been nearly as enjoyable.
Yeah. And then I guess that transitions to my fourth thing, which is a kind of my catch-all bucket for this, but I think it's true, which is the voice of the book, the voice of Watney, Weir's voice. There is a, how would you could, it's a serious book and it's certainly smart, but it's very light considering that it's the dude's life on the line.
I think it's, to steal the tagline from my former podcast, Book Rageous, I think it's serious, but it doesn't take itself too seriously.
Right.
Watney is the same, that he is obviously a serious person who's achieved all the things that it requires to become an astronaut, and he's in a very dire situation, but he doesn't take himself too seriously. So the voice is playful, and it's very human. Like, I think if you get apparently killed on Mars and your crewmates leave and then you wake up alone with a giant thing sticking out of your chest, your first thought of "I'm pretty much effed" is that's pretty true. And his reactions, the reactions that Andy Weir lets the Watney character have throughout the story, are really believable. That he gets so angry when he finds out that the crewmates don't know he's still alive, and how that plays out, I think, in the movie especially, is really well done.
Yeah, and you know, I think the unfair, largely unfair, but also usable shorthand of dad humor, you know, is, if you haven't seen it, convey, you know what it is, which is it's not sophisticated. It's not an ironist, but it's also not despondent. It's also not urbane. It is very kind of salt of the earth kind of jokes. And I think there's a high low thing that's going on, very interesting, as Watney and the rest, and frankly, Martinez, who's his best friend on the Aramis, used this jovial undercutting each other self-deprecation as a way of diffusing the tension, right? It's a usable and understandable narrative, you know, a personality choice. Like, this would be a helpful thing to have. Humor is a very useful tool to have in times of stress, and it serves Watney well. And that kind of believable experience of it is also fun to watch. It just makes it then that much more interesting to watch. Where if you compare it to Apollo 13, which is pretty deadly serious and straightforward, and it like the whole experience of Apollo 13 has a crew cut. Not that there's some moments of levity, but that's a different, different vibe.
Yeah, there's this wonderful moment, I think pretty early in, maybe even the first time that we see the folks at NASA, like, thinking about Watney and knowing that he's alive and, like, trying to solve the problem, where Venkat Kapoor is like, "I wonder what Mark Watney's thinking right now." And it hops to Watney's entry in the journal, and he's wondering, "How come Aquaman can control whales? They're mammals. It makes no sense." And it's like, yeah, this guy is trying to survive alone on Mars, but he's also doing that thing that all people do, which, like, our minds wander and we think about weird stuff, and that Weir recognized that part of humanity would still be true even in a really dire situation. I think adds to the believability and the relatability of this in a way that, you know, something like Apollo 13 is very dramatic, but doesn't acknowledge all the multitudes of a person's interior life in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really interesting to see how that voice is so different. Cause in a lot of ways they're very similar. It's like a lot of the pleasures of Apollo 13 manifest themselves in a similar form, you know, competence fetishization, like, make this thing work with this thing. And it's a bunch of people with glasses and really smart, and they're trying really hard. But there is a, the framing is different and the attitude is different, and so thus the experience is different. They both can live side by side without feeling like The Martian does not feel like a copy of Apollo 13. It feels like it's in a similar genre, but the difference is meaningfully, or the experience is meaningfully different, which is what you do in genre makes it fun.
Yeah, I think that's fun and very true. And I think we have to point out that it's really genius that Andy Weir makes Mark Watney a botanist.
Yes.
He's not an astrophysicist. You don't spend 300 pages or 2 hours of your life watching someone talk about science that you really don't have any experience with. We all get what's involved when a person cuts a potato into quarters and the potato has eyes and they're going to plant those potatoes in dirt and you need something to fertilize it. And then you get like the fertile land of poop jokes that result from the way that he has to fertilize his potatoes. It's totally relatable. We've all tried to grow something and everybody's had that experience, at least of thinking about that kind of science. It's a very accessible place to put your character.
I think that's a great point. And I had in my notes that I think in the movie and the book, the potato farming story is the best part of both of them. And for the reason you just say, it's the most Robinson Crusoe, I got to figure out how to have food. It lends itself to the epistolary structure because he's giving us updates about how things are going and narrating what's this. The voice, he gets to be a botanist and there's poop and he's trying to survive. Like, talk about high-low. He's got to dig up his own crap and then eat the stuff so he doesn't die. He can't get any more high-low than that.
Like, it's only better if Mary Roach is there with him to document this and tell jokes about it too.
And then, like you say, it's the science that's the most explicable to a generally well-educated person. Once we're synthesizing oxygen over an iridium catalyst, I'm a little out, to be honest with you. But on the potatoes, like, I get potatoes.
Yeah,
I eat those too. Well, I'm just like this.
You know, like, you watched this with your kids last night, and you've got, what, fourth grade in the
fifth
house?
And third. Fifth and third.
Yeah.
So
right.
On average, so like, yes. My average my average child is a fourth grader.
Fourth grader, your average child. Don't tell them that. No. We're lumping you together into, like, one collective child. It's fine for your identities. that if you made it to, like, fifth grade science, you get the water cycle, so you understand what he's doing with trying to, like, create evaporated water that then forms condensation. And then rains down. Like, you can understand that. You can comprehend what's going on with the plants. I don't think you even have to be reasonably well educated to get to that place in the story.
Well, I'm saying grade school is reasonably, like, you understand a little bit of, like, if you're interested in the science at all, you need, that's the most accessible piece, is like water and air and fertilizer and potatoes.
Yeah. And it's very light on, what is it from Lauren Graham's memoir? She talks about, like, doing a medical, being on some sort of medical drama.
Right, yes,
and that when
she was
before she had learned medical terminology, she would read her script. And instead of saying the terminology, she would just go medical. And you can, we've definitely all also seen space movies where it's like science word. And it's pretty light on that. Andy Weir makes everything very understandable and does explain the complex parts, but even those are jokey. Like, hey, I've heard it's not a great idea to go dig up a giant radioactive thing.
Yeah. Fire, death, space, they all go together, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Okay, on rereading then. So that's a big chunk why we like The Martian, why it works. I think it holds up in a lot of the same ways. The thing that's different now is it's not new. At that time, it's hard. There wasn't something kind of like this. I mean, that's why you get a phenomenon, is it feels like a fresh approach to something people care about. And I think those are the reason that goes to it. But let's go to rereading. Been a while. You like me, have seen the movie several times since you've read it. So now probably we were ready to be surprised by things in the book or had forgotten. Anything in the book that jumped out to you I can't remember or I forgot or any what was unexpected?
You know, I think I had forgotten exactly how many catastrophes Watney has in the book.
Right.
Like, you get the sense from the movie of the just ongoing problem solving and that there's a win and then there's a failure and then there's a win and then there's another failure and, like, that his life is on the line and in all of them. But there's just the repetitiveness and that I was invested every time about what was going to happen. Like you, I have seen this movie many times and it has entered the realm of, like, if it's on TV, I'm going to watch 25 minutes of it. So I think this was maybe only the second or third time I've intentionally watched the whole thing. But I feel like it's impossible to read the book now without hearing it in Matt Damon's voice.
Impossible.
Which is a gift. It's wonderful. Yes. I found that to be really delightful. I also, I mean, 2011 was such an interesting time culturally and where technology was, that I was really stuck on some of the little details that we are used to build out the world. Like, some of it is exactly what would happen today, or believable for what would happen today, where like the Postal Service makes a commemorative stamp.
What a weird detail that was. Yeah, I didn't have that, but that was so strange.
But I was like, this is such an obscure thing, but it would happen. Like, I feel like Andy Weir sat down and thought about what would be going on Earth right now. And, you know, they make a commemorative stamp, then it turns out he's not dead. And so then they have to retract it. And there's the stuff around the news cycle I thought was really interesting in the book, and that there's, you know, the Watney Report that's happening. And if he wrote this book today, or even if they remade the movie today, it's not just the Watney Report that's on all of the 24-hour cable news channels, but like there are Mark Watney memes, and there are people like taking the videos that are released from NASA and turning them into TikTok things. And Watney probably ends up with like an Instagram account that he's posting to from space, and all of that like was
there's
just
a whole Reddit thread about how it's all fake. That certainly would happen.
Right, there's podcasts like documenting the updates about Mark Watney each week, right? And then Equal podcast about how this is all completely made up and he's just in a soundstage.
I have thoughts about those very questions. I'm going to save them for the end where we talk about, like, let's not think about it too hard, but actually think about it too hard, because I agree. Anything else in the reread that jumped out to you?
Man, not really. It was really fun. I was surprised by how much fun it was to reread it, because I felt like I wasn't going to be surprised simply because I've seen the movie so many times. And it was just great. I think there's a little more gravitas in the book than I remembered, because the movie has its heavier, and the movie has its poignant moments. But the book definitely made me pause several times and be like, where is the trauma therapist that should be emailing him?
That's interesting. Like, one of my observations was the book's tone was a lot lighter than I remember, because I think the movie's actually darker, like literally darker, because but like, you know, seeing Damon actually pull a piece of thing out of his stomach is way different than the saying, I just pulled and him crying and screaming. Like, it's just more visceral.
It is. And I think different things come across as poignant in the book and the movie for that reason, that stuff just, there are some things that seeing them makes them so much more powerful.
Yes.
Like the scene near the end where he's writing to, I think in the book it's Martinez, but in the movie it's Lewis. And he's saying, if I die, I need you to talk to my parents. And it's one paragraph in the book. So you kind of take a pause and like breathe a deep breath with Mark Watney about what he must be feeling in that moment. But watching an actor portray that and hearing Matt Damon's voice do it was, had a much bigger impact on me there. But I think I agree that the book is lighter in tone than I remembered, but also maybe just the sheer volume of stuff that Watney's overcoming in the book, because the movie I think does a really good job of like taking the biggest beats and the most fun scenes and pulling them out and making them into the narrative. But there's still so much more that happens on the page that you just have this building sense of like, oh my God, what this guy is going through.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. A lot of storms. They need to invest more in meteorology, survivability on Mars, it turns out, from the very beginning. That's one. I think there was a lot more pretty detailed science stuff that I've skimmed about chemistry, especially. It's fine, but like that's not it's not cinematic. So the only one you really need is, I think, that he blows himself up a little when he's trying to make water, because that's part of the potato farming thing. Everything else about the oxygen and my urine and hydrazine, it's like it's a tough hang for a lot of those things.
And I think the first time I read the book, I read all those details because I didn't know where it was going and how he was going to survive or not. And so you need to know what's happening and how it works. But I certainly skimmed the science on the reread.
Metric system. I understand that's what scientists use and astronauts use. But as a reader, I'm like, how big is this thing? How heavy? How far are we going? Just a lot of in my head. You know how they did a YA version of The Martian? I need an imperial system of The Martian. I think they did.
They did a YA version?
I don't know what they cut out. I guess the first line, right? There's very little cussing, but and understandably, that's where you're going to cuss the first line.
Uh-huh.
But I need an imperial system version of The Martian. Or maybe that would be a nice feature for Kindles or e-readers to add, where I can select, can I convert all these things into the imperial system? Give it to me in yards, to quote Notting Hill.
That should be a setting for just all books.
I agree. Don't... Or the internet. Can I just have a Chrome extension that converts all metric into imperial?
Our colleague Clint is definitely listening to this right now, preparing to text us about how we're being too American-centric about that.
I'm not being American-centric. I'm being me-centric. I don't care what other Americans think. I'm trying to understand how far is 3,200 kilometers? I have literally no idea without getting out my calculator.
Of imperialism. Just selfish because of me. I'm on board with that.
That's right. So there's a lot of that. And I get that's what astronauts do and blah, blah, blah. But in terms of an American audience, very tough hang.
That's what astronauts do, blah, blah, blah. Yeah,
very good.
Well, hello and welcome to The Martian.
I'd forgotten how many kind of strange variations in point of view moving between Houston and Hermes and Watney. And then there's a couple of scenes that are Watney that aren't first person. They're third person describing him. That was a little unusual. I had forgotten there was kind of a poo-poo platter of points of view there.
Yeah, I had forgotten those, the ones that just like describe the astronaut moving about. And I didn't find them to be terribly essential. But I think for all the other stuff, like especially moving between all the different the different conversations and the different NASA people that we meet on Earth, Weir manages that pretty well. You always know where you are.
One is, and I don't know who I was in 2011. I don't remember. My consciousness has evolved to this point where there's a couple uses of describing something as ghetto that is not all right. It's not what we shouldn't say that, but they're also not describing the right thing. And just don't do it. I've used this as a younger person to describe what a sort of makeshift solution to something, I guess, is what that means. And it's not meant overtly racial. It's just the regular structural racism that's built into language and American understanding, especially white American male understanding of things. You don't need it. You didn't need it. Yeah. It's not great. It sticks out. I would get rid of that in my bespoke Kindle edition as well.
I would get rid of that. I thought for the most part, it aged better than I would expect something from 2011 to age. But there's also the little moment where the potatoes have successfully grown and he's getting an email from the University of Chicago that's like, you know, once you have grown crops on a place, you've colonized it. And he's like, so I've colonized Mars. And like, we definitely talk about colonization differently now than we did.
I noticed that one too.
Than we did 10 years ago. And I don't think that he would be celebrating it that way, or there would be different language around it.
Yeah, there's one about, you know, a joke about the Chinese putting an eyeball in your food. I'm like, I'm not sure that's what we're wanting to do here. But on the whole, those stuck out to me now as the kind of reader I am now. And they don't, all of it stinks, but like it's so easily avoided. You know, it wasn't built in a lot of ways that it could have been otherwise. Let's see. Potato farming is the best part. Weird variation point of view. I think another thing I notice now, and I think it's especially coming back from the movie where actors add things to personality, but reading the book, the characters have almost exactly the same personalities in the book. The Hermes crew, I guess Commander Lewis is a little more Tom Hanksy from Apollo 13, and she's not literally wearing a crew cut, but has sort of a more militaristic commander point of view. But there's a certain sameness to the personalities all the way around. Yeah. You know, it's Weir's first book. They're all, I think, kind of versions of Weir's voice and point of view. Not bad necessarily, but in watching the movie, Chastain does something different, and then Michael Pena does something different, and Donald Glover certainly does something. I was like, oh, they're adding wrinkles that weren't really there in the text. And that's not bad. It's just something I noticed in reading.
Yeah, and I think I was having the same thought, definitely, especially about Donald Glover. I love him in this role.
Yes.
Like, he just really brings something to that Rich Purnell moment. And Jeff Daniels, I think, is underappreciated in a role like this.
Yeah, I guess that takes us into the movie then. So let's do another response. Sponsor break, and we'll talk about the movie in its own terms.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess, and in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression-era Danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions. And this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, the movie. The questions we usually ask, this is a good adaptation. We don't have to spend any time. This is a good adaptation.
It's a good adaptation.
Any general thoughts before we get into more specific questions?
It opens differently than the book opens, yep. And I find it so smart. Like, you could open the movie with the Watney realization of I'm here alone on Mars, but then you'd have to do the flashback. And I think just opening with the drama of the storm and watching the thing happen and watching them leave, it was such a smart change to make.
Chemistry among the crew, Scott spends 90 seconds on that before the storm hits, like a couple jokes back and forth, Lewis telling them to shut up, essentially, mm-hmm. in her very militaristic but forthright way. It gives you just enough of a substrate to have a relationship that you care when they have to leave him behind,
yes.
Right? Like, because in the book, he's already gone, so you're like kind of backward filling that was hard or what that meant. The other thing is, the storm where Watney gets lost, you don't get that. I mean, implicitly, it had to have been the same, but it's pitch black. There's dirt flying everywhere. Mm-hmm. There is no going to get Watney.
No.
There is no, like, Jessica Chastain's, like, guilt about it later is actually kind of weird in hindsight. In the book, it plays a little better that she's guilty, but if you look at it objectively, mm-hmm. in the moment, it's like, you are going to kill everyone if you spend one more minute looking for that dude who is out in that pitch blackness being surrounded by death space. Like, it is very a tough scene at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something on the whole that works better on the book, because space is beautiful. Mars is cool to look at, and you just don't do that in a book. So I don't know what to do with that.
And you get that moment near the end where they have Matt Damon talk about, like, sometimes I go out there and look at the vistas just because I can. And you relate to that in the movie in a way that I don't think he has that line in the book, and
I don't remember.
Nothing's missing because it's not in the book. But after you've spent all this time looking at Mars and imagining what it would be like to walk around there and be the only person, or like he says, everywhere I go, I'm the first one who's ever been there. It's, you know, what that experience would feel like is really powerful.
Yeah, I mean, and this is I think space looks great on film. Mm-hmm. Going back to 2001 or even Moonraker with James Bond, spaceships are cool. Spacesuits are cool. Jet engines, ion engines, whatever. You can throw whatever science garbage. I'm sucking it all up. Star Wars is... space is cool on film. It's just great. So I think books can never do that. And it's a testament that The Martian, the book itself, that you get some sense of scale and, you know, desolation and beauty at the same time. But when you watch the movies, like, oh, yeah, there's a reason movies can do things that books mm-hmm. can't. Anything else that works better in the book? I mean, you can't film the Ermi spaceship sort of slowly rotating. That's just cool. I would say that's a screensaver, that thing. It's awesome.
Yeah, it is really cool. There's a couple things that stood out to me. On the fun tip, I think all the disco stuff is fun in the book, but it plays so well in the movie.
Yeah,
He's listening to this stuff. He hates it, but then he's also kind of like bopping, like in the dad joke vein, like sort of bopping around while he's driving the rover, listening to Donna Summer. That stuff was really wonderful. And I loved, well, not loved because it's really sad, but I appreciated the scene after the Hab explodes from his little fire experiment and how devastating that is, that his whole, like, the place he's living and most of his safety is tied up in that, explodes and is gone. And Damon brings that to life so wonderfully, that this, how devastating it is, how scary it is, and that then he then has to, like, pick himself up and duct tape a tarp together and put it over the opening and then get inside and, like, hope it's okay. And I think he talks in the book about having a little cry after that, but it really comes across on screen better. And just this, I think the sense of humor, Matt Damon is perfectly cast in this movie. The sense of humor plays well on the page, but is just wonderful in somebody's voice. And getting to see a face do all of the things and experience all the things that a person would experience. Also, I like that they changed the ending and that Watney actually gets to do the Iron Man trick.
Yes, I like that too. We should talk about the very, very end as well. Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly the hair choice. I never will understand the hair at the end. It doesn't. His hair after being in space for a year by itself. Anyway, I will get to that. Yeah, I think having Watney be embodied just matters. It's it's an uncomfortable truth. I know there's this thing about book nerds and the book is always better, but I'm sorry, sometimes humans are great. And watching a human have feelings is different, especially if it's done well. And here's the other thing, is that where books can generally be better is interiority in thinking, right? Which has to be dialogue or voiceover in a movie. But since The Martian already is interiority in voiceover, it doesn't add. You don't learn a lot more about Watney's thoughts in the book than you do in the movie, because it's kind of presented in the same way, as opposed to something like Pride and Prejudice, where you get a lot of in Lizzie's head, and that kind of stuff is very hard to communicate. So that the depth of character, the depth of interiority, which books crush movies and TV on generally, it's an advantage that the book kind of takes away. Or the movie, you know, it already is like, anything I'm doing could have been, can be filmed. It wasn't one of the reasons the movie works so well. Anything that the book does do better, though? Did you have any, like, I kind of wish or I missed or anything else like that?
I think the book captures really the tedium of that experience.
I had the exact same point. Thank you so much. Say more about that.
Yeah. Then just the repetitiveness of, like, I did this and I'm going to do it again tomorrow, or when he, especially in the front parts of the book, like when he's first doing that 20-day, 20-soul experiment to try to drive the rover and see if he can make it all the way to get to Pathfinder. We're with him with entries almost every day about it. Like, I drove and I laid out the solar panels and I cleaned them off and this thing is happening. And now I'm just going to sit here for 8 hours and watch 70s TV shows while they charge. And that's what I'm doing. And the repetition of these really tedious things, like, it's tedious to keep your human body alive on Earth.
It really is.
And like, you know, as I think we all had that experience early in the pandemic of, like, I have to make myself another lunch on another
unbelievable
day.
This is unconscionable. And 2 minutes of flossing every day.
How dare. And that this guy has got to, like, do all of those things, and it has the added layer of, like, and he's eating a potato for every meal and then spending 8 hours watching 70s TV, and then he just knows that the next 20 days are going to be the exact same thing plus whatever new disaster science and Mars decide to throw at him. Just how exhausting that would be, and then how resilient Watney has to be. That just comes across so much more in the book, because you get so much more space in a book to illustrate those kinds of things. And they, as I said, like, I think they did a great job in the adaptation of pulling out the big stuff, but you do lose that sense of, like, all right, he's been there for 400 and some odd days, but, like, what does that really feel like? What were those days like? And most of them were probably boring.
So boring.
And, yeah, really, so it's a slog. Mars for two years is a slog, and he did it.
Yeah, I think that's a point I hadn't thought till you said about it, the tedium, but also one thing that books do, because you spend more time with them, is you can have 200 pages in the middle that for most people takes 2 to 3 hours to read, which that's longer than the movie, and that's just the middle bit. So the whole thing does feel like it's more of a saga, an epic, a slog, because you spend more time with the book. So you get more. Now, again, it'd be different if this was a 10-part miniseries, which it could totally be. We'll talk about it in the middle, maybe talk about the end again. But yeah, that sense of, like, how hard it is and how much time it takes, and repetitive, physical, grueling, mental, physical, and emotional effort. it really took. But outside of that, I think the movie's better in almost every other way because of what movies do and how cinematic and how, you know, one of the things I remember us talking about as a book riot sort of staff at the Palms, like, this is going to be a great movie. Like, almost instantly, Ridley Scott was interested. I think most of us who were thinking about it was like, Damon was like the number one draft pick for being Mart Watney. I think it holds up especially well, though I want to talk about that a little bit too. So yeah, I think those things. Now, the movie does a lot of things better. I think the crew has better personalities. I think we get to know the characters in Houston on Hermes a lot better. We just do. They're essential parts. The movie makes more proportional time for them.
Yes.
Than the book does. Look, you know, Chastain is very great. I love Chastain. She's doing many things that I like. I very much like Chastain in her Zero Dark 30, Miss Sloan, Molly's Game mode, competent woman, telling people how it is, knowing more than other people, having to make hard decisions. She's as good as anybody at it. I think it's a great part for her.
I agree.
She's wonderful. She's my number two draft pick after Damon, of course.
Yeah.
In terms of your cast power rankings, who else is important here to get right or to do well or to do right by the whole thing?
Yeah. You know, I think that Teddy running NASA is important to do right. And I really like Jeff Daniels in this role. Rich Purnell comes to life a lot more. Like, I would not have read the book and said, man, they really got to be careful about who they cast as Rich Purnell, but putting Donald Glover in.
Unbelievable
that spot.
Fastballs from Donald Glover coming off just, out of the bullpen, throwing 99 the whole time.
I was having to remind myself, like, okay, 2011, I think Community was airing. And Donald Glover was, like, just sort of coming up then. We didn't know anything about where his TV career was going to go or that he was going to have a music career at all. But you can see, like, glimmers of he's just great. I love Kristen Wiig in general, but I wanted more from the Annie character.
Say more about that. I didn't mark that down, but I agree with you. But why are we right about this?
I think that's an incredibly hard job. It would be super stressful to be the press face of a news story like this. And Wiig is, like, almost too funny and too light for it. Like, I wanted just someone with a little more darkness or, like, some sharper edges. Like, I wanted to believe that she was really mad at them and also that they had to care. And
her,
I think,
anger
she's
in the book doesn't come in the movie. We don't get it because she's mad and she's throwing elbows and chastising people and really in the mix. And she's just doing a lot of reacting. And boy, I can't believe this stuff.
I was trying to think about who I would cast in that role instead. And like, I don't know if you've watched Insecure, but
I have not.
The woman who plays Issa Rae's best friend on Insecure, her name is Yvonne Orji, and she has that same, like, very sort of sharp, polished presentation, but also you believe that you do not want her to get mad at you. And I think that's what that Annie character needs from this. Yeah.
Yeah, she's not. So the totemic press secretary is of course, CJ Craig. And one of the things that makes CJ great is she's tall and she's goofy, but is also fiercely competent and better than anyone else at that job. And because we see them fail, right? We see Sam fail and the president, even Leo. And whereas Teddy does just as well when he's doing his stand-ups, right? It's like, why isn't Teddy doing this all the time? And we never actually see her in front of anyone. So it's a little clear what value Adji has. I think in the book, she is a useful foil to the dudes kind of astronauting it up and being like thinking about how humans are going to understand this.
Right.
Yeah, she's not bad. She just doesn't add much.
I think that Weir sold that character a little bit short. Like, a person who's the head publicist or whatever, her press secretary, I guess, for NASA would be incredibly smart and would not ask, can he take his helmet off for the photo op outside?
That's a great point. I've noticed that. I didn't think about putting that in her mouth, but that idea at all, it's like, no, everyone should understand that there's no facility for this to happen.
Yeah, but then in the category of things we just try not to think about too hard, especially in the movie, he's like mounting GoPros in the corners of the hab and talking to them. So can he not take a selfie, and can he not hook the GoPro up to that computer that he hacked after they gave him directions and send them pictures of things?
We're a little loosey-goosey on the bandwidth to Earth.
Especially in 2011.
Yeah. A little loosey-goosey. I think we're... It's one of those things like the powers of a superhero are conveniently scaled to what's useful because sometimes Professor X can take over the mind of everyone on Earth. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like he can just sort of suggest that you like want coffee instead of tea. But you're like, okay, we're trying to tell a good story here, but I agree with you. It's a little unclear. Like once we get the thing set up, he could get new music as compressed MP3s. It might take a week, but he's got to dig rocks for 6 days. He can download, you know, the Pearl Jam album that certainly was his favorite at the University of Chicago. Yes. That's kind of weird. Works other things that work great. I think the crew is wonderful. You know, mm-hmm. do I need Sebastian Stan and Rooney Mara? Do they give me a whole lot? They're fine, but it's like, is it Kate or Rooney Mara? I think that tells you all you need to know. They're both not Anna Kendrick, so right. I'm not sure what to do with that as well.
And I wanted more from, is it Sean Bean who plays Mitch Henderson?
I've got a question about this. Why is there a Scotsman in NASA? What, do we not have no Americans that can be flight commander? What happened
here? That is Sean Bean, right? I was like, that's it a Lord Sean of the Bean. Rings person, yeah. But I didn't
Boromir,
care.
Boromir, who I did like, who yes. in the Council of Elrond, he was at the Council of Elrond as right. Boromir, and he was the guy saying you're all being idiots.
It's true. It's
I love
true,
that. I don't know if they did that on purpose, but it's
I
great.
I think Mitch Henderson gets to be angrier on the yes. page in the book than he gets to be on screen. And that tension between Mitch and Teddy about should we tell them or should we not tell them and when should we tell them and who's going to tell them and what is our ethical responsibility to everybody who's involved here is a bigger question in the book that I know they don't have time to do all of the things on screen. But I wanted, I guess, a bigger performance or a more emotional performance from Mitch Henderson than we get from Sean Bean.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I hadn't thought about that, but you want a little bit more of a, you know, an Inherit the... Is it Inherit the Wind? What's the one that's the Scopes Monkey Trial where you get the collision of ideas? Yeah. You want a little bit more of like both sides with more of a full-throated... Because it's actually, I think, a fairly interesting discussion. Rowan, my daughter, in the middle was like, I can kind of see both of their point of view. I was like, yeah, I can too. And it doesn't really... I don't know. That's where a Sorkin maybe would be helpful to use a Jeff Daniels. Trying to play both sides and how they're both right and they're both wrong. The truth is there's no right answer. They're all compromised and very difficult.
I think a Sorkin would have been a useful thing there and some Sorkin-esque casting might have been useful because I was watching that thinking, I've had more heated arguments at this about work and I talk about books on the internet.
That's right.
And like, and they're talking about like people's lives are at stake and they're not even kind of raising their voices at each other. There's not much passion happening here. Like I think you would be, it would be heated and it just doesn't get heated on screen in the way that I was like, come on, a little bit more.
That's the other thing that struck me is that no one screws up in a way that we would say screwing up and no one gets mad. Mm-hmm. No one gets mad at another person in this.
Yeah.
Which I guess is not the point because it's really human versus nature. And so humans, we all got to stick together, right? Nature is, if nature is a nightmare, space is a complete catastrophe.
It's human versus nature up on Mars, but it's still humans dealing with each other down on Earth and in the NASA situation. And I just did not believe that those discussions would all go in the way that they go on screen. Right. And Andy Weir, I think, is responsible for a little bit of that. Like, but there is more heat on the page than there is on the screen of these people disagreeing with each other because of how high the stakes are and because it really, really matters that they try to get it right. And like Mitch, I think it's really bold when Henderson looks at Teddy and calls him a coward.
It is very bold.
But it's like quiet on screen.
No, they pulled the punch. I think that's what you're saying is they pulled the punch with Mitch.
Yeah. And I wanted a full punch, like fists pounding on the table. You're a coward. How could you do this? Like if you're ever going to yell at your boss, that's the moment, Mitch Henderson.
Yeah. You want Jeff Daniels in the newsroom kind of vibes here. Something else going on with that. And we don't know if this is a club Weir has in his golf bag yet, but interpersonal relationships have sort of two conduits in both this and future Weir novels we can talk about. It's either we're busting each other's balls or we're figuring out something together. Those are the relationships. Those are the vectors we have. And that's fine. But there is a version of this where some of the interpersonal stuff is more interesting than, don't we all really agree in 45 seconds to spend the next year and a half in space to save Watney when I got kids at home? That's what I was thinking. I was like, really?
Beck
and what's his name? You're like, that was... Now, maybe they would come to me like, was it that simple? But again, that's not what the movie is about. And I get that. Yeah. But it is a weakness of the whole thing.
To jump to, could this be a 10-episode Netflix series? Which it absolutely could. I think you would do more of that. You would get like Annie going home from work and, you know, like venting to a friend or a partner about these stupid guys that she works with who don't understand that she's the one who has to get out there in front of everybody all day. And then you would get the conversations that the like partners of these astronauts are having together back on Earth about like, I can't believe they're doing this. And oh, really? I kind of support it. Like you could build out that whole world in a way that made everybody's humanity richer, I think. Because I had the same thought, like I don't have kids, but if my husband were like, you know what, I'm going to come home 533 days later. Is that cool? I think I could probably ultimately be in the place of like, I get what you're doing, but I wouldn't agree to it until I had the moment to be like, yeah, I'm going to agree to this, but we're going to talk about what I'm doing here for you also.
You would feel some kind of way about it. You would feel some kind of way about it.
And if you've got kids, you're talking about missing another almost 2 years of your kids' lives, and that's a real hardship. Yeah. Being the partner of an astronaut isn't easy in the first place. Like somebody needs to be angry at somebody else in this story, and it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, like, in the most tense interpersonal moment of Apollo 13, because we're using some of these as foils, is Bill Paxton and Kevin Bacon arguing about whether or not it was Kevin Bacon's fault that he stirred the tanks and the thing, and real animosity there, and it bubbles up, and Hanks has to intervene, and they have to come to sort of detente, and it's resolved a little bit. But you get a little bit of the frisson of like, people are different, their lives are at stake, and this is high stress, and probably you're going to even do more punching each other in the mouth emotionally, maybe even physically.
Especially in within the crew back on the Hermes. Like, I think that, you know, they've worked together for years. They've been in this very small space. They know each other super well. And like, yes, I get that astronauts are chosen to be even keeled, but everybody, no one's even keeled all the time. And in a high stress situation, like you left your buddy on Mars and you didn't realize it, and now you might have to stay in space for 2 more years. Like those people are going to know how to push each other's buttons. And they're also going to know in an argument what each of them is going to tend to do. And I think like you could have there could have been a scene there of them hashing out, what should we do? And someone is resisting and someone really wants to go. And it becomes this like, well, this is the thing you always do, you know, which is what would happen with five people in a tiny space.
Also, the ship is way bigger in the movie than it's described in the book.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's an unbelievable condo in the sky. Unbelievable stuff.
Condo in the sky. Yeah, the bunks are much swankier. I had that note also that like you actually get a bunk in the movie, and in the book it's like we get these little weird hammock things, and at some point when he's achy and tired near the end, he figures out how to like submerge his hammock and take a bath. And that was a moment for me of like, I understand you, Mark Watney. I would also be trying to figure out how to have a hot bath in space.
Ridley Scott likes to shoot cool stuff in space, and God love him for it, because I liked it. But I remember in the book there's this one scene where they're getting together to decide whether or not to turn around and get Watt, and it's like, and the conference room is barely big enough to fit six, because of course you only need to fit six. That same conference, the same, their own Council of Elrond, happens in this like space lounge that has multiple seating groups that can fit six. I'm like, what is this? This is the Club Med Saturn. I don't know what this is.
I think that's also part of why the movie doesn't convey like the tedium and the pain of being an astronaut, because we don't see him going to bed in a weird hammock thing, and we don't see the crew all smushed together around a table really thinking about how much they wanted to kill each other sometimes because they couldn't get away from each other.
Right. You got 50 days of just to play with those tunnels where you kind of propel yourself by using those uneven bars. Like I would do that for 3 weeks. That looks great. Yeah. Not Anna Kendrick is just using the exercise machines.
It is a crime that Anna Kendrick is not in this movie.
Are we sure she's not? That's not Anna Kendrick.
She's in a bad space movie that Netflix produced earlier this year.
The litany of bad Netflix space movies is a real genre and worth discussion in some other thoughts and formats. While we're on their casting, I think at the time Matt Damon is the obvious choice. I think maybe even today, even still the obvious choice. We talked about this before about Project Hail Mary. There's a similar character that's very similar. Though I will say this, in talking about how the moral turpitude of the characters in The Martians is relatively undisturbed, That's not necessarily the case in Project Hail Mary. A little bit more interesting stuff going on there. True. So I'm glad to see that, though you could be, Matt Damon could, I think, do that as well. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask Jeff's always question. Are we sure this movie is not better if Zendaya is the main character?
We're not sure. I think Zendaya is a little young.
She's a little young.
I cannot think of a... I was also thinking about the Matt Damon question, and I couldn't land on another, like, early middle-aged white guy that I thought could do that role better than he can. But I was like, okay, you know, obviously astronauts don't have to be middle-aged white guys. I would love to see Regina King be an astronaut. That is, I landed on that. I'd love to see her in the role. Zendaya in another 15 years, maybe.
Well, maybe let's linger on that, because what does Damon do that these people we're talking about do? You need smart. You need to play smart on screen, which is, it sounds hard or it sounds weird, but some people read as smart, or like, this is a dumb thing to say. I think Hanks is great. I don't think he reads as smart as Damon on film. And I don't know if it's because of Good Will Hunting or all this Harvard stuff we have about Damon, but whatever it is, Hanks is the crew commander, but I don't think he's Watney necessarily. Whereas I think Zendaya reads as super smart and really funny and droll, and she can do Euphoria and she can do Marvel droll stuff, like, you know, in Spider-Man stuff. She can do all that kind of stuff. If she's a little bit older, I would pick her. I'm not sure she wouldn't be better. Here's another thing. What if Chastain is Watney? Not funny enough?
I don't think she's funny enough. Yeah. Or
Glover could do it now.
Donald Glover could 100% do that. And I started alternative casting the rest of the roles. Like, I had this moment, and I'm sure it's just from watching Breaking Bad, where I was like, could Aaron Paul have been Mark Watney? And I can't decide if it's just the overlap of, like, I'm going to science the shit out of this, and that I got to see Aaron Paul do that in Breaking Bad. I think he might be too dark. For the role, and maybe not quite physical.
The voice isn't right. You have to be able to pull off some cheesy jokes that you know are cheesy, but you enjoy them anyway.
Yeah, and in other characters, like, I love the woman who played Mindy, who was Cameron on
Mackenzie
Halt and
Davis.
Catch Fire.
She's great.
Yes, Mackenzie Davis. She was great and well cast. But I, you know, it would be interesting to see somebody new do this if they were making it today. And I loved. Have you watched Mythic Quest on Apple TV?
You've recommended to me. It's on our, you know, when I have to get a flu someday in 10 years when I'm around other people, I'll probably fire that.
There's
up
a woman, Charlotte Nikdal plays this woman named Poppy Lee on the show, who's like a programmer who's funny and takes herself seriously, but like also like gets a little wounded sometimes. And we see some of that with the Mindy Park character, and I think Charlotte Nikdal would have been great in it. Also in Mythic Quest, Danny Putty from Community has this like completely different role than what he played in Community, and he's this like very sharky kind of business dude on Mythic Quest, and that made me think like they could have put him in the Kristen Wiig role in an updated version of this, like a sharky dude, you know, publicity guy.
I like that. I think the other one I had, and because the I'm going to watch The Chair at some point, so Sandra Oh's in my brain. I kind of wanted her for the Sean Bean role. She's tough.
Yes.
She's smart.
I love that.
Takes no quarter. She gives no quarter, takes no crap. I think she would have been really good in a little bit of sharpness, a little more sharpness, I think, in the texture palette of this people in Houston, especially.
Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. Today's episode is brought to you by Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi. If you like pretty things, like I like pretty things, I got something for you. The stunning sequel to the worldwide phenomenon Children of Blood and Bone is now available in a deluxe paperback edition with gorgeous spray-painted and stenciled edges and an exclusive excerpt of the earth-shaking Children of Anguish and Anarchy. Now, this is a series for you if you like action, you like world building, you like mythology retellings, lore retellings, specifically of a West African variety, has all that and more. It was also an instant number one New York Times bestseller, a Good Morning America book club pick, and now both Children of Bone and Children of Virtue and Vengeance are available in these deluxe editions. They're pretty, they're gorgeous. The finale to the series is coming June 25th this year, so you can get the pretty editions of the first two books and be ready for the last book. You see what I'm saying? So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi for sponsoring this episode.
All right. Best not to think about. I don't know what the thinking behind Matt Damon's hairpiece at the end is. It's terrible. It's bad. It's distracting. I don't know what they were thinking. Especially it's clearly a wig. I don't get it at all.
Especially because now we know what Matt Damon in his early 50s looks like, and he doesn't need that hairpiece.
No, I don't. I'm not. It's supposed to be a lot. It's not that much later, I don't think. No dates in any of this, which is the right move. We don't want to try to think, well, this really happened in 10 years, but like, his hair at the beginning of it is a regular Matt Damon's astronaut haircut. I don't understand why he's kind of doing the accountant dad who doesn't get it cut off enough, but still
glasses.
Wants to. Yeah, that very tough look for Damon at the end. I don't understand that at all.
It is. There's no edge in Damon in that last glimpse of him.
Yeah.
And this character has edge through the rest. Not a lot of it, not in a like super dark way, but he has some flavor. And that's just a very bland moment there.
Related, Mark Watney, if this actually happens, he comes back, he's the most famous person in the world.
Yeah.
Right?
He's writing a book, he's going on book tour, he's on every talk show, and now he's on every podcast, and like maybe he goes and does a guest lecture at NASA.
We dig up some problematic tweets from 7 years ago. We now have all of his thoughts on camera that are being scrutinized within an inch of his life. I'm not sure I'd want to be Mark Watney coming back.
Can you get canceled while you're alone on another planet?
I think the internet would say yes. I think the internet would say yes. Other unanswerable questions. The book talks about this a little bit. The cost benefit ratio here of saving one person is a little disturbing. On the other hand, I think it might go down a lot like this in a lot of ways.
I think it would, because it's not entirely rational.
Right.
It's the weight of this one life that's so far away and that everyone's been watching, mm-hmm. and what he's trying to achieve. I think the upside there of we saved this guy feels bigger to everyone who's making that decision, or to most of the people making that decision, than the possibility of some astronauts died, which of course would be big and bad, but also we have experience feeling that. As people on
so
Earth.
Commander Lewis brings only disco, and Johansson brings only 70s, and no one else brought any media. Watney himself brought nothing for a three. That was it. Those are the two media dumps, were Johansson's mm-hmm. 70s TV shows and Lewis's disco. The rest of the characters brought nothing.
I had that question as well. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to know what would be on your data stick.
That's a great question. Probably, yeah, I guess. I don't know. Like, am I getting a terabyte drive? I can put almost everything I've ever listened to there, right?
It made me think of how much the technology has advanced between The Martian and Project Hail Mary, because Weir mentions in Project Hail Mary that, like, they have computers and files that have, like, every textbook ever written. He could get any album that he wanted. He has all the things. The technology is so much richer. But 2011, you got to narrow it down.
I think they could have put a hard drive, a 10 terabyte hard drive with almost everything on there. I think as a gag, it doesn't work if you think about actually you could have basically all the 80s and 90s music you want on a Blu-ray, which, or, you know, mm-hmm. a solid state disc, which was around there. But anyway, kind of funny to think about too. Also, this is a really small one. This is so weird. It bothers me so much. So Watney's been watching all the 70s TV and he's like doing the Fonz. and he takes a picture doing the Fonz, but it's like super blurry. And right away, they're like, really? He's doing the Fonz? I'd be like, who would know? Who would recognize? Doesn't look like anything. No one also, gets like, that he's doing the Fonz in that picture.
People just do thumbs up in pictures.
Yeah, the Fonz and doesn't own thumbs up. Yeah, thumbs ups existed like before the Fonz. I don't know. I didn't, that was a misfire. It's kind of a weird thing.
I agree.
Let's see. You have anything else that struck you as don't think about it too hard? Or
I mean,
he's
got these GoPros and he hook them to a computer was the one that really stuck out to me there. I'm sure there are.
Well, that's the counterpoint to your how much media it has. Apparently enough to have high-res video storage for all of this, right. But we couldn't have slapped on, you know, the catalog of Nirvana onto a thumb drive or something else like that. Kind of strange.
Yeah, it would have been nice for Weir to wrap in, like, okay, we get it that he's tired of disco, but like, what does Mark Watney want to be listening to?
I thought that was even a better question. All of his media sort of, like, found. He's reading, like, Agatha Christie because of what it's there. He's listening. But, like, in... I think he's trying to figure out what his hair is doing. I think that's what he spends most of his time doing. Like, what is he listen to is a really great question. What happened to Watney's media stick is a really
great
question.
Like, what does he want to be listening to? Or what's the book that he wishes he had? What's the TV show he wants to be watching for the 100th time? What Mike Schur vehicle is Mark Watney's favorite is really the question. Like, you're going to space. You're definitely taking a Mike Schur TV show. So which one is it?
What is it that you're taking? I mean, just because of there are more seasons, you take Parks and Rec, I think.
I think that's true. And so speaking of that, it just is occurring to me, since we were talking about the trolley problem kind of situation of which one. I think William Jackson Harper would have been good in this, who played Chidi in The Good Place.
Yeah, really good. He could have been any number of characters, I think, actually. Yeah,
he could have been an angry Mitch Henderson, maybe.
He could have been one of the astronauts. Martinez. Yeah, I think that. I love Michael Pena and everything. Michael Pena always gets roles like this, and I always am glad to see him do stuff like this.
And only because I'm preparing my soul to watch Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac in Scenes from a Marriage.
Okay.
And I think I would have liked to see Oscar Isaac in something here.
Isaac as Watney is interesting. We got a Poe Dameron. Matt Damon's a good-looking guy. Is Oscar Isaac a little too good-looking to do this?
I'm willing to find out.
That's a tax I would gladly pay for science.
For science.
Yeah. Let's see. Any other things? Any last thoughts about this? Clearly could be a 10-part Netflix movie. Obviously could be.
I love the tacked on ending of the movie. I think I love that they come back to Earth, that we see Matt Damon like doing his thing, even though I don't think that's what Watney's life would actually be like in that moment. But the like, you just begin and you do the math and you solve one problem and then you solve the next one. Like, that just speaks to me.
It's a very 2021 vibe.
It really is.
You know?
I hadn't thought about that, but there's probably a reason. That's always spoken to me, but it really speaks to me now. Right. And I did like that they let him do the Iron Man trick in the movie, even though it's silly. And I liked that they made it Lewis in the movie who goes out to get him, because in the book, is it Beck who goes out to get him? Yeah.
You got to have it, man. I think that's the smartest thing they did is they made the crescendo of the action, the rescue, where in the book it's him flipping the rover, right? The actual going to get him, they still have to blow out the thing, but it doesn't have the same, you're out there on a limb at the very edge of like fingertips touching in the void of space, which you really get. And it's really beautiful. They got wrapped up in this really orange ribbon and it looks great and it's very emotional. And I thought it was very cool the way that they did that. Yeah, and they give Lewis a lot more to do. She makes decisions and she's the one that's, as a commander, you know, let's do this, don't do that. I'll decide first. We're asking that. Just great stuff.
Yeah. Oh, here's a quibble about the book that we're thinking about Lewis again. So in the book, we get that little bit where like Watney indicates that he tells Beck, like, I know that you and Johansson are into each other. And then it turns out that Lewis has detected this as well. And Lewis like gives them permission to get it on in space because they're going to be gone for another 2 years. And that's terrible judgment because like, are they not going to break up or at least have a big fight and hate each other? Like, there's a reason that they don't want the astronauts joining the Million Mile High Club, as they put it in the book. Like, why would Lewis...
Put it, I think you're in a no-win situation there, because if you say no and they're already doing it, that goes bad. I think there's there's no good way out of that. I'm not sure what's right, but I hear what you're saying.
But like Lewis brings it up in the movie and is like, by the way, I've detected this and it's fine. You have my blessing. Like if they want to sneak around, whatever, people do that. But like Lewis just sort of outright encourages it.
But what do? Like I guess you're saying
you just don't
blind eye it. You blind eye it.
You Midwestern it, Jeff.
That always works out. That's worked out for both of our family systems over time. It's a good putt we want to read.
Let's just
the military should take. Have you tried being a Methodist?
Now an excerpt from our Somebody's Daughter podcast episode.
It's I mean, again, the interpersonal dynamics is something that wasn't a strength. And again, this is Weir's first book. We haven't talked about the backstory. Self-published and becomes a hit, gets picked up by Crown, becomes a hit. I think there's rough edges around it that actually kind of make me appreciate it even more, frankly.
Yeah.
That the core of it is such a good idea, executed with heart and humor and intelligence. And so what if it's not perfect around some of the other stuff? No book is perfect. I will take many imperfections like this over so many sort of well-honed, polished, drab river stones that don't stick out.
It's optimistic and hopeful in a way that we all want to believe in.
Yeah.
And Andy Weir pulls that off really well, I think.
That's our show. Thank you so much, Rebecca. This is a good time. We'll come back and do another one at some point. I'm not sure exactly what's next on our list. We were talking about some of the other movies we want to talk about. You've Got Mail is still on the list. Dead Poets is still on the list. But we want to do an adaptation. And it's been a while since we are. A good 10-year check-in. I'm not even sure to call this the deep breath before the plunge, because Project Hail Mary continues to sell very well.
Yep.
It's a lot of what you like about The Martian, maybe better in a lot of ways. And there's going to be a movie. I think Gosling is now tapped to be the lead.
That's excellent.
It's fine. I think it'll work. Okay. It's not especially inspired. I think he's like not Matt Damon. I kind of wish that Weir had written it. So Watney is the main character in Project Hail Mary as well.
Can we not just cast Matt Damon as a different character anyway and be like, he's good at astronaut
stuff? Why does it have to be a different character?
I mean,
just Mark Watney, he would, again, it's not clear that it's set in the same universe, right? In Project Hail Mary, there's no reference to, like, remember when Mark Watney was in space for a long time? Like, I don't know if we're in the AWU, the Andy Weir universe, but if it was, and again, I don't want to spoil it too much, they're looking for someone to do a thing in space for a while, wouldn't you be like, hey, Mark, remember when you survived in space for 2 years? And then some of the stuff that Project in Hail Mary actually happened? Anyway, that's what I want.
Maybe
my heart
Matt
desires
Damon-
that.
Now my heart desires a Matt Damon, Mark Watney cameo in the Project Hail Mary movie. That would be clever and funny.
As they're getting ready for Gosling to shoot into space, Watney's mission commander, or he's like the crew, he's Capcom or whatever.
They should do that.
They should do that. That would be pretty great. Zendaya should be in Project Hail Mary, as I can't even remember the main character's name.
P. And I think, I'm so interested in how they're going to manage.
We can't talk about it now. It's too interesting.
The other main character of Project Hail Mary.
Casting's going to be very tough. I don't think Zendaya could play that one.
I don't think she
has a lot of range, but that's some range right there.
Folks, I'll just say it again. If you have not encountered Project Hail Mary in your reading life yet, you're not going to do better than the audiobook experience of that. It's ideal.
It makes me wonder, because there was a redone audiobook of The Martian, because the original one, I think Weir narrated himself or he subcontracted out himself. It's too bad that Damon doesn't do the audiobook of The Martian. It would be great if that was. I know it's very good as it is, but and for movies like this, I feel like if I were doing movie adaptations, part of the deal to get the person to get the role is also part of your deal is to go record the audiobook and do a new recording of the audiobook.
It seems like if they were making the adaptation of The Martian now, Matt Damon, it would be not out of the realm of possibility to think that he would do the audiobook. We get big celebrities doing audiobooks.
Rosamund Pike is doing the new Paula Hawkins, and she's like in Gone Girl and Wheel of Time, like Rosario Dawson did the one for Artemis.
Maybe they'll do a 15th anniversary edition and it can have Matt Damon.
I still don't understand the economics of getting celebrities to do audiobooks. I don't understand it. I never will understand it.
As our, favorite podcast guy, Bill Simmons, would say, that's a possibly unanswerable question.
Possibly an unanswerable question. Like, how much does it cost to get Jessica Chastain to narrate anything to me? All right, Rebecca, thank you so much.
On that note.
We'll talk to you later.